Alan, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome. We're going to discuss a rather, for many of us, a rather historic topic of hyperinflation, although there are also CMEC members that have experienced hyperinflation from very close by. So there's a varying amount of experience in analyzing companies that that endure hyperinflation in their environment. So I'd like to give the word to you to ask us some of these questions.
Sure, thank you. So as you say, it's important for those who experience hyperinflation as well. So I'll give you a little bit of background. Is that it was several years ago the ISB was approached by a group of South American standard setters who were very concerned about not hyperinflation, but high inflation. And they considered that the financial statements were losing relevance because of the high movements in prices. So Glass, which is the group, prepared a paper for us, which we discussed in December last year, not coming up with the slides. It might be omnipotent sometimes, but it says December 2015. But we discussed it last December. And essentially, if we step back and have a look at what the hyperinflation standard does, is that when you've got very high prices, and I'll mention how we define that in a minute, you essentially stop doing your normal accounting. Well, you do your normal accounting with things in the books, but you take all of the numbers and you have to adjust them by some sort of index, generally an inflation index. So all of your assets, everything get adjusted up to new values to try or adjust it down to try and reflect the value changes, and then you put that plug in where the difference is recognised as a gain or loss. Then once you exit hyperinflation, you then, whatever numbers you had in the books, become a new starting point. So that's like your deemed cost, for example, off you go again with your normal accounting.
The consequence of applying hyperinflation results in one extra line item in the financial in the results.
Essentially, a net gain or loss from hyperinflation.
That's the only. So the revenues, whatever, are not restated.
They are all restated. They are all adjusted up by this index. So all of the revenue expense items are adjusted for inflation or general price adjustment. So, and same with the assets and liabilities. So instead of having the original of 100 that you paid, you have to adjust that up for the inflation. And so by the way, so most of the recent experience with that.
No, just because I think before we move on, I think it's very critical that we all understand what hyperinflation really how it really works out, because we have heard it. Suppose you have 100 revenue in every month. And there is indeed inflation of say 15% a month. What revenue do we report at the end of the year?
You'd have 1,200. You'll have to keep your scurrying into the cupboard to grab that. This is a standard not many of us ever look at very often, to be honest. there are some statements in there about how you do it for expenses, such what assumptions you make. You're supposed to be revenue. I can't tell you. I'd have to go and actually read out all the paragraphs out of the standard itself.
But I think your basic question is it 100 times 12, or is it a different number?
I think
revenue line.
It'll be, because the revenue at the very beginning of the period, it was in a price level that's very different to the end. You have to crank that right up to the current, to the end of the period, essentially, to get it across.
So you put the price index to the end of the period? Not the average of the entire period.
It's supposed to be the end of the period. You're supposed to have this general level.
So you pick
up and bring everything over.
So in this case, it would be a lower number. There's inflation. You have 100, 100, 100, 100.
Yeah. You have to adjust.
You have a lower revenue number than 1,200.
That's right. It's higher. What you're doing, you take out the earlier low number. And you raise that up to a higher number and then bring it across. Because once you finish, you've got your numbers are at the new higher levels. And then you stop doing hyperinflation accounting and continue on.
So with FIFO accounting, if you bought your inventory on January 1 and you made all your sales on December 30, you would print a massive profit without hyperinflationary accounting.
So not only the PN, not only the financial position is adjusted, not only the assets and liabilities, but also the expenses, revenues,
and
are all adjusted for the price level changes throughout the year.
Correct, and all of the comparatives are adjusted up as well. You have to bring them all into common. So,
so a revenue, a change in revenue, also the previous year, would that also be adjusted?
Yes, all the comparatives. All the comparatives have to be adjusted as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Directly from the trenches, if you will.
Okay. You're digging it out.
Yeah, there are two worlds. One, those accounts that will adjust themselves. I mean, prices will change in some cases on a daily basis. Your liabilities will change on a daily basis. Your CDs will also be adjusted for inflation. But then you're left with your fixed assets and your net worth. What we did in Brazil was trying to take care of these assets that are not per se adjusted for inflation. So we created, as Alan just mentioned, a kind of system to adjust your fixed assets and your net worth. So if at the end of the year, your fixed assets adjusted for inflation have raised more than your net worth, there was one effect, and vice versa. So the point is, how do you deal with the fact that PPE doesn't change for inflation, and that your net worth is usually not changed for inflation? The problem with that is that at the end, it helps you to perpetuate the inflation. Because if everyone and everything is adjusted for inflation, is used to inflation, then you get squared inflation. The 10% inflation in the second month is no longer an inflation. It's just an adjustment. And then you have on the second month a 12% inflation. And on the third month you have a 14% inflation. And that's why if the whole country is doing just the same, then you get hyperinflation as a result of this remedy, which is the side effect of hyperinflationary accounting.
We had an in-depth discussion about this yesterday, trying to understand. On the other hand, I see financial reporting as an observer, not as a policy, not as causing inflation. I don't see financial reporting as causing inflation, it's more observing inflation. And even though inflation is bad, if it's there, it's the question whether at what point in time, maybe as of 100% or as of 25% or maybe always, I mean, that's the principal question, should you correct for inflation? I mean, that's one of the big questions for me is, where do you get your price correction from? Because if you can manage that, I mean, you create a whole new problem. Because how do you correct, for example, if you have you apply the inflation level to all assets, even if it's, for example, a tax asset, which is probably nominal. I mean, do you apply the price index to a tax asset? Because that could be quite distorting. Because that may not be valid.
That's
a credit past.
Addressing your point, which theoretically it should be true, but to a certain extent, what this caused in Brazil, and I need the help of Carlos, is that at a certain point in time, you could no longer find out whether the companies would survive after inflation. Because it meant that you had financial statements, everything was adjusted for inflation. So you couldn't know whether the company was actually doing well or not, notwithstanding inflation. Because inflation is not the problem, because I'm adjusting my financials for inflation, but definitely inflation is a problem.
So what is the problem?
Inflation, definitely, it is a problem.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if you adjust everything for inflation, then your financial statements are, of course, adjusted.
Yeah.
But your kind of general health. It is just like changing the thermometer. It's like, I have a fever. No, you no longer, you don't have a fever anymore. You are okay. I'm not. And every month you have a new thermometer. So it's, I have 110. It's fine.
Yeah.
Because fever is 115 only this month. That's the problem with a general adjustment for inflation. You get used to that.
Well, we may not agree, you know. Peter.
You are all too young.
Thank you.
When I started business administration at Stockholm University, I was an expert on inflation accounting. On all graduate courses, we did inflation accounting, and there were several methods, the CCP, the CCA, or whatever the name was. And what I learned back then was, okay, is this easier to understand than if I don't adjust the accounts? And, well, I haven't lived in a hyperinflation economy, but I have lived in a high inflation economy. And the question in this document is whether high inflation should be recognized when we have 8% change in consumer price index. And that is an economy which I have lived in. And I can tell you, it doesn't help you to recalculate the accounts. I mean,
usefulness.
The usefulness will not be higher. If it helps you when you have 100% inflation, I think we can all agree that with 100% inflation, everything is a mess. Whatever we do, it is just difficult to handle. So probably this is less difficult to handle if we recalculate it. Should it be 50% inflation? Well, to me, probably. I think it's very difficult to handle 50% inflation. Below 10%, no, that I have experienced. I don't think it's that difficult to handle. And then eventually everything went down to 4 or 5 and so on, so the problem wasn't there any longer. But there's a flip side on this also, and that is when you consolidate a subsidiary in a high inflation country, you end up with problem, because when you have high inflation in the country, the currency declines.
True.
And then we have this two different kind of methods that we consolidate foreign subsidiaries, and the one that is by far most frequent, the current method, is not really fit for high inflation, because we import different kind of effects in the accounts that are problematic. If you recalculate, which a lot of Swedish companies did in Brazil like 15 years ago or so, if it was 20 maybe, you need to use the monetary and non-monetary, it was called back in the days, but maybe it's, the name is the monetary method or for consolidation. No one uses it, but you need to use that. So it's not only for the individual country or the accounts in that country, it's also a consolidation issue.
Yeah, we used at that time the FASB system. I don't remember if it was 52 or something like that. So, and Brazilian companies prepared a special set of financial statements in dollars or in any other currency and sent it to the parent company because it didn't make any sense in whatever unit we had at that time.
But you end up with a monetary adjustment on net monetary asset that normally is positive. But when you consolidate that group using the monetary method, the consolidation creates a negative net value change. And those two must be met on the same line in the income statement, actually. But to me, having some kind of high inflation accounting starting at 8%, I don't think that's all.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, just one final comment. It's what really puzzles me and really concerns is that seeing that coming from Brazilian standard setters, a few years ago, and 8% was something as well. That's way above what we have. Now we have 7%. So that's a kind of cultural bias. Whenever you see things, well, the moment you reach 8%, you have hyperinflation back, and it's like, I can't react. But as a Brazilian, but no, 8% is not hyperinflation.
Yes.
Thank you. Ready at the moment.
Two quick comments. One is that I'm also a little bit concerned about this very technical way of restating the financial statements, irrespective of what the actual inflation rate is, just because I think that high inflationary environments, and usually a lot of the other problems that go with it, actually affect consumer behavior. So for example, if you look at Ukraine in 2014, some crop science products have actually doubled in sales in reported terms, despite the massive currency devaluation, just because the farmers don't really know what's going to happen to the currency and what's going to happen in other respects. So I think if you then actually just start completely restating that, you're suddenly pretending that sales in 1 year have quintupled or something, which is actually probably quite far from the truth of the underlying business. But the second point is, coming back to the question of what is inflation and what is hyperinflation, there's actually a lot of concern in the financial community. CFA Institute has done some work on that, the actual inflation measures are not really very relevant to the world that we actually live in today. So overall, probably most inflation rates are very much understated. Because you know, we only look at the price of smartphones, but the asset bubbles that are being created by QE in real estate, in stock markets, are not actually being taken into account. And you have situations like, I haven't really verified this, but allegedly for some Spanish retailers, rents have increased by somewhere between 100 and 1,000%. So this is obviously creating huge problems for their business and their reporting, but the ECB is still saying, oh, we're in a deflationary environment, so these companies would never get the benefit of any inflation accounting. So I do think that whatever the logic is for hyperinflation should also probably be applied to very, very high inflation. I see your point. If it's really, if you're talking about 8%, then it probably doesn't really make sense. But just conceptually, I think this hard cutoff of 100% over 3 years.
It's not a hard cutoff. It's just one of five indicators.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. But I think you could have a situation where it's 30% or 50% over 3 years, but the reality is that some of the businesses are actually dealing with a lot of the problems that they would be dealing in a true hyperinflationary environment.
Okay. Carlos, please.
First of all, I think when a country is in hyperinflation, and I think those points more or less. So we're really talking about high inflation, not hyperinflation, which is the case of Brazil and many other emerging market countries, Russia, India, many others, maybe Turkey. So it's not irrelevant. If you look at the composition of European companies to these countries, it's quite big. I made one calculation recently of the average inflation of the big British multinational. It's been like 5%. Just to give you an idea of how important it is. So then the question is, what's the reasonable threshold? And that's it's not an obvious answer, right? Brazilians, at least the Brazilians that proposed this, they think the threshold is about 8%, right? And then just adding to Paulo's, I give you a very simple example, two very simple examples. One, a company that has 100 PPE, right? So 8% a year over 10 years, it's 2.2 times compound, right? So it really, and if a company has 100 and they generate some measure of profit that PPE is generating, it means that the return on equity will be twice in 10 years if you don't adjust for inflation. A bit more than twice because it's 2.2 times, right? So another example, so that's a distortion. So 8% over a longer period of time creates a relevant distortion. So another example, if you have a company that has 100 of cash, right? And just let's assume, interest rates are the same as inflation, 8% in this case, right? Every year you get eight every year, right? So you have 100, you have 8 return. But it's really zero, right? Because inflation is 8. So that profit is totally illusory. If you apply inflation accounting, the profit will be zero, according to that very simple example. So the question is 8 a reasonable number, is 5 a reasonable number, is 10 a reasonable number, which would go back to Peter's comment, which is, you know, very, very hard to define. I have no very strong opinion. But I guess 8 is a sufficiently high number to create a relevant distortion over time. And that's why those guys are talking about this number or a number of different angles. So that's my first comment. My second comment, which you mentioned here in the paper, which is currency restrictions. I think it's a totally different matter. I would even, I think it's another topic, because this relates to what's the exchange rate that you should use after you get the local currency number, right? So even when we have inflation accounting, you get a real number, a Venezuelan Bolivar number, a Turkish lira number, whatever, and you convert into, you know, the parent company currency. So Venezuela is a great example, right? I know companies that are still booking at, I think, 12 bolivars per dollar. And the market now, which is not free because there is a currency restriction, but the closest to the free market is 170. And for, you know, for some companies, Venezuela became a very important, because just because of this, you know, accounting error, and companies are taking a long time to react, to adjust to the reasonable number. But what it's hard to define a reasonable number because there is a currency restriction, so nobody knows the reasonable number. So you can just, you know, estimate. You can do estimates about it. So I think that that's a totally different discussion, which is what's the right way to consolidate into the current.
I do agree. The reason I raised it is, as Peter points out, when you've got high inflation, you should actually see the currency deflate. And when somebody puts sort of strip things as they do in Venezuela, you're not getting that natural offset. So you're reporting these really high profit, high sales numbers, right, but they're adjusted. But unfortunately, the currency, the official one, is not going to compensate for that. So I think it is actually potentially relevant for external investments.
Yeah, definitely connected, yeah.
May I ask, I guess, what would the consequence be of a change to 25% for multinational companies that, you know, have a US dollar and, you know, a euro as a functional currency, and maybe have some subsidiaries that operate in a high inflation environment. Would those be affected by a change in the standard?
Well, the question, I actually don't know empirically. To Peter's point, to go back, say, over the last 30 years, I think every country in the Western world has been in and out of this at 8%. Where I came from, we had double-digit inflation for 18 years, and so I did some graphs on about 4 currencies, and there were 4 different places, and the inflation rates over time, it would be in and out over 8%. I can't tell you 25% how effective, and I haven't got enough data about how much investment is involved in for those particular ones as well. But that would be something you might want to do before we actually launched onto any project.
That's
one of the recommendations. I don't want to do that.
But I'm still confused. If you take a multinational company like Shell that operates in a high inflation environment like Venezuela, would Shell be affected by? Would the accounts of Shell be affected by hyperinflation accounting?
Its subsidiary would go with hyperinflation accounting.
So it's only those functional currency. So it just has operations there, but the functional currency is still pounds.
No, Shell would not switch over to hyperinflation accounting.
They could
if they had an investment in the country that had hyperinflation.
They could use within the subsidiary a functional country, local currency. I don't know. I mean,
I think it's, at least in the US, the accounting is if you have a subsidiary whose functional currency is the functional currency of that country, then you are allowed to apply it to that subsidiary. If it's not an official subsidiary whose functional currency is that currency, then no. That's my understanding.
So to be honest, from a risk, I mean, that would cause many people.
So Clorox is a company I looked at. They have a subsidiary in Venezuela.
Yeah.
They apply that accounting to that subsidiary, and then it gets rolled up into consolidated entity with the hyperinflationary accounting applied. But I think if you just had a, if an oil company just had a rig in Venezuela, then they don't, they're not allowed to apply.
And we just used all that.
Yeah. Right.
As I understand, U.S. GAAP allows you to change the functional currency. So if you are under hyperinflation, you may book in dollars instead of Venezuelan bolivars. IFRS, I believe it's different. You need to apply inflationary accounting to the local currency, and then you convert that result back to your...
Yeah. The local subsidiary, you use hyperinflation, that becomes your set of IFRS financial information for that subsidiary, which then comes in.
And that's already happening in Venezuela. I think there are only two countries that now apply to that 100% rule today. In Venezuela, I know European companies that are doing inflationary accounting on their subsidiary in Venezuela and translating into...
We've had this as well in South African investments in Zimbabwe, and they have very high.
Okay, we have 5 minutes, Paul, and then I'd like to address the question of what the staff priorities that we should...
I was thinking I might at the end of what I say. Carlos has spoken about the distorting effect of 8% inflation or whatever, and frankly, inflation is a distortion. Money becomes less valuable over time, whatever the inflation rate happens to be, and that has an impact in the accounts and how we understand the performance of the business. But we live with that. We understand that that's the nature of business in an inflationary environment, and there always is some degree of inflation. What we're talking about here is a vastly different degree of distortion, which is basically throwing up the entire way in which we report performance by companies in order to reflect not just inflation, but frankly, a currency no longer being a relevant measure of performance, no longer being a currency that is of any use to anybody. That seems to me a very, very big step to be taking. It can only possibly make sense in these circumstances where the currency is only relevant as such. So, the question that Alan's asking us is, should we look to extend this extraordinary distortion to other circumstances? My personal answer is no. Paolo's talked about the sort of knock-on consequences of that distortion in the real world, potentially, and that clearly is a concern. I cannot see any real interest in having this degree of distortion imposed in circumstances other than the currency being irrelevant. And so, my personal answer to Alan's question is, for God's sakes, let's put this aside and not take it further. And stop there.
Well, this is interesting because I think, having heard all the views around the table, I think what Paul said is reflecting, I think, most of our concerns. The current threshold is pretty high, and it ought to be pretty high. That's your observation. Am I validly concluding that that's more or less the view of all the members of the CMAC? In that case,
that's definitely my view. I think the 100% is just too high. I think it should be.
You think it should be lower?
I think it should be lower.
And what level do you think?
I have no idea, but we can ask people.
So
100 is too high.
And is 8% too low?
Mm-hmm.
But 100 over 3 years.
If it's closer to 8, then the compounding of 100. The number that compounds to 100.
Okay. I'm sort of throwing whether I would throw this in or not from the beginning of the conversation. Paul talks about a level of distortion, and it really the need to be very high. There has been when we've been interchangeably talking about currency changes and hyperinflation, and they are linked. So what happens when you have a 20% currency distortion in 6 months? And whether you need to restate your financial statements for that sort of change. Because that's a huge distortion on what's going on in your business. And then, so where do you draw the line? And that, that the scary one is, and I'm leading this question, the scary one is the 20% distortion, which is causing, which is interesting, is the Canadian and U.S. economy are very linked. And there are a lot of Canadian companies that are, you know, substantially sell American, buy Canadian in parts, and there has been a 20% shift in those currencies. And the answer, Paul, is you don't even, in the Canadian example, you do not try and adjust. You need to understand what's going on in the bottom. The currencies still work. The economies are used to these changes. It's not a big deal. So I'm sort of, I know that 20% is, on a short period of time, does not work. You don't.
I agree. But my problem is with recurring, you know.
Are we answering? Can we ask Alan the question?
I think we have one member that would support a lower level than 100. Maybe 20% as proposed is too low.
I can support a lower level than 100, but not 8.
But 100 over 3 years, 20% per year, you
say. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is
so,
this a trick question?
just to make it clear, we would be moving from 26 a year to 8.
Yeah.
Well, why do we have to sort of just stick our finger in the air? Like, can't we do some kind of statistical analysis of what is truly an outlier level of inflation and apply that as opposed to just
I don't think that's the question Alan's asking, throwing numbers out.
Should this be a priority? That's the main question.
It should be a priority, and I actually think it's slightly deeper than that. Go back to Peter's comment. Yeah. You know, you did inflation accounting, we did current cost accounting. What sort of indices are we doing in terms of, we used to do specific indices for companies based on their actual, that type of inventory. We had all sorts of indices we would be pulling on. Is that the way to do it? This standard, and I don't want to be derogatory about it, but it's very blunt. All it says about, to your point about adjusting P&L and so on, it just says you need to adjust, you need to adjust sales and other expenses into current amounts. And I don't know whether how consistently you're going to get those. And when they say it, doesn't even tell you how to calculate a general price index. So it's a very blunt instrument that deals with those major distortions, or in Paul's case, when things have changed so dramatically. And I think it's a real risk if you take something like that and just lower the threshold and accidentally get companies in. So if you were to lower the threshold, I'd actually want to revisit this more fundamentally. I don't think it's a priority for us. At the moment, to be honest. So there's that issue. And as to what the level is, I agree with Dan in the sense you want to actually have a look and see if you can get some consensus about what major distortions are. Because it should be temporary. You know, I go and have a look at comments about Zimbabwe's economy now. This fact that they're in hyperinflation has disappeared because, you know, you can't have 1,000% inflation forever. Eventually it settles down, so it's getting in and out of this temporary blip.
So do you want a sense of priority as well?
Yeah, sense of priority. And the other thing too, by the way, as soon as you go down to Arenda's point, if you went down to 8%, how you calculate the index becomes really quite critical. At the moment, at 100, there's a bit of, you know, fuzz in there, and you don't have to be perfect in your calculations, and that's only a rule of thumb, but if you go down to something like 8, it matters. And I'm worried about that as well. So my sense is there are too many big issues in here for us to simply say, well, let's just do a narrow scope.
Just one final comment. The moment you have regulated industries, which prices are based on inflation, and if you adjust your balance sheet, all utilities will have the prices raised by inflation, and then you spread inflation all over.
Regulatory regimes can adapt for that. Let's look at the clock. We need to move on for, I think it is, our coffee break.